BBC News.
And welcome back to City Visions here on KALW. I'm Joseph Pache. Our topic tonight is Online U, how the web could change higher education in California. Online learning has been around for a long time in our state, but over the past few years, a new innovation called Massive Open Online Courses, or MOOCs for short, has emerged that could revolutionize higher education. MOOCs are open college courses offered via the web in which thousands of people enroll simultaneously to create dynamic interactions and spur new ways of learning. Many of the leaders in the MOOC movement are here in the Bay Area, including startup companies such as Coursera and Udacity, both created by Stanford University professors. And this January, San Jose State became one of the first universities in the country to pilot MOOCs for college credit. While MOOCs have gained rapid momentum in terms of both enrollment and media interest, there are many unresolved questions about how these courses could impact the shape of college education in the Bay Area and across California. How will MOOC students get credit for completing these open courses? Are MOOCs a lower-cost way for California to serve the growing numbers of college students in the state? And what is the quality of the student learning experience when thousands of people are taking the same course? And why would professors want to teach in such a strange and unfamiliar format? Well, tonight we're discussing these questions and more with our panel of Bay Area experts. Here in the studio, we have Clarissa Shen. She leads strategic business and marketing at Udacity, a Palo Alto company whose mission is to bring accessible, affordable, engaging, and highly effective higher education to the world. Clarissa is the co-founder of BetterChinese.com, a K-16 Chinese language curriculum and platform used in over 800 schools, and she has an MBA from Harvard Business School and a BA from Williams College. Welcome, Clarissa.
Thank you.
We're also joined by phone by two guests. First, we have Dean Flores. He is CEO of the 20 Million Minds Foundation, a nonprofit that began in 2011 with a mission to grow access to higher education in California by eliminating unnecessary hurdles to affordability. He served in the California State Legislature as an assemblyman and senator from 1998 to 2010 and as Senate Majority Leader from 2008 to 2010. And Dean has an MBA from Harvard and a BA in Political Science from UCLA. Welcome, Dean.
Thank you.
And finally, we have Dr. Ellen Jun. She's provost of San Jose State University. She took that post in January 2012. And prior to this role, she served as the associate provost at California State University at Fresno, where she also worked as the director of technology innovations for learning and teaching. She has a BS in psychology from the University of Michigan and a PhD in cognitive and developmental psychology from Princeton University. Welcome, Dr. Jun. Dr. John, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, there you are. Thanks. Welcome. So, of course, we're going to open our phone lines to our listeners in about 10 minutes or so. You can dial 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 to call in with questions or comments. And you can also post a comment on the KLW website, or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So, Clarissa Shen, I wanted to start with you. Tell us a little bit more about the structure of a massive online open course or MOOC.
So I think what gets lost in some of the discussion around MOOCs is that it's more than just the scale of it. Absolutely, I think the numbers capture the media's attention in terms of the thousands of people that can take the class, and we really, you know, have the scale and the platform that can do that. But what gets lost in there, I think, is really almost reimagining of what a online learning experience can be. As you mentioned in your introduction, it's certainly nothing new, right? Online learning has been around 15, 20 years. You can even go back to correspondence courses and, you know, distance learning back in the day by mailing books and CDs. But I think what has really changed is in the classroom now you have a couple things happening. One is that, especially at Udacity, we have a huge focus on interactivity. And so what you see as you enter into a class is that it's not just about the lecture. In fact, you know, 1-2 minutes into your first course, you're going to be confronted with a quiz. It can be as simple as a multiple choice, single choice, fill-in-the-blank, textual answer, or as complex as simulations, modeling, visualizations, coding type of exercises. And really what you see in this new sort of classroom experience is a scaffolding of these interactive quizzes and projects and challenges. And it's almost, some people have likened to a game, although we believe, obviously, it comes with its own we worry about the connotations of gamification, except it is very much like a game in that you're getting through multiple levels of interactivity. So that's the sort of learning experience. And students have reported saying that this is much more like a one-on-one tutoring experience, because as they engage in each activity, they get immediate feedback, they get hints around how they can do better, or, you know, they also get really addicted to, I got it right, I can actually solve this myself, and they feel really empowered by that. That's sort of the learning experience. Surrounding that, you also have these forums where you have thousands of students engaging, and your cohort of people who are working together with you become people who are solving the same problems. So you get to see, I'm not the only one that has this problem. I'm not the only one that struggles with this concept. Someone else is asking these questions, and students vote up and vote down the most helpful questions and also the most helpful answers. And their peers will jump in and say, look, this is how I thought about it, how I solved for a problem. You know, let's think about it from this perspective. And so there's thousands of students engaging in these forums. We do moderate them as well. We have our instructors. San Jose State faculty are very involved in engaging with students in there as well, in those classes that we offer with San Jose State. And then we also have a wiki that grows up around a course. And that's where knowledge, answers that are shared, valuable additional pointers, resources can be pointed to and added to a course. And you can imagine the body of knowledge that grows up around a course, and that's added to these wikis. So I think those are some of the main features around the basics of a MOOC, and they do vary a bit across courses. Additionally, our MOOCs that now count for credit have additional services tied to them as well, including online proctoring, so authentication of the student who's actually taking the course is the student receiving credit. And then also we have student support services as well, which is 24/7 availability of a chat line and tutors for people who really need to help have additional help and engagement.
Wow, that's it's very interesting. Your description sounds like when you first talk about it, it sounds like there's thousands of students. How personal of an experience, how intimate a learning experience could this possibly be? And you've talked about various features that you've built into the experience that really bridge that potential gap.
Yeah.
Which, again, sounds a little counterintuitive when we think of, well, the in-classroom learning being the model that most of us have grown up with, even if perhaps we have done some online learning. But that's for most people, it's really been in a classroom with a real live person in front of you. And you're describing ties and learning possibilities that are just multiplying more so than perhaps in the classroom.
How do you
explain that?
I think, you know, it goes back to really, if you think about the classroom is optimized exactly for that. You know, if you are in a classroom and you're optimized for student-teacher engagement, and that can never be replaced online, right? You won't ever see through a computer screen the reactions of a student. And I think that's the value, you know, why people care about small classrooms is because the greater ability of a teacher to read signals of students. But if you think about really expanding and, you know, our mission around broadening access, and you're talking about thousands of students, we really care about reading individual student signals. And how do we make that happen? We make that happen by doing these really interactive exercises where we can immediately see how students are engaging. And then we can see the questions that pop up right around that question, around the challenges that they're working on right at that time. And so that allows us to have that one-on-one engagement with students that we otherwise wouldn't see from a head nod or maybe a smile, you know, as they're engaging.
But the professor isn't there monitoring the reactions of the students, right? Because students can log on anytime they want. So who's actually moderating and at what hours of the day and night?
So, you know, I think what's really interesting here is, yes, the faculty may not be there 24/7. That'd be pretty onerous on the faculty. But we get a lot of signals. And it turns out with even, you know, 20,000 students taking a class, you're not going to get 20,000 questions. Mm. The most valuable questions and most common questions tend to be repeated and voted up by students. And those are the ones where really professors have huge value added components where they can really engage and add a lot of value. So they're looking for those particular kind of signals, and they don't always come up 24/7. In fact, We allow a little bit of time to vote up and down for students. We also help moderate it. We do have people on our staff who help filter that and surface the most important questions for faculty. And it's also students who engage. So you'll see peer-to-peer engagement as well to help solve for some of these questions on the boundaries. And then the really value added from instructors, they come in at certain times based on the data. And really, this is all becomes much more data-driven, whereas I think previously you're sort of, I may be looking at you and you're nodding and smiling at me, but I have no idea if you're really understanding what I'm saying. Mm. Now I actually get a data signal based on actual activity we've done together to say, hey, I need to engage. And this is actually, there's a gap in the student learning. And that's where the instructor comes in.
Hmm. So it sounds like there's many people involved in the moderation of a course. And it seems interesting to me that you say that you have moderators who are kind of shaping the content of mm-hmm. the conversation or sort of filtering some of the questions that get passed on to the instructor. Yeah. How does that work in terms of an instructor's sense that there's how closely do they work with the moderators to make sure that they're properly filtering yeah. the questions that are coming from students as opposed to perhaps censoring the conversation or taking it in a different direction?
Yeah, I think, one, we care very much that it's a very open conversation. I think the moderators are also in there for etiquette, partly, to set the right tone. And so students know that it's okay. We encourage everyone to chip in and help students solve for answers, but we don't want people to just post an answer that takes away from the learning. So things like that. But these moderators are very much part of the team together with the faculty. And the instructors are in some ways, if you think about the movie analogy, they're the director and the screenwriter that helps bring together these other people behind the scenes to create this course, this movie-like course, right, and this experience for students. So the faculty are very much, directing this team and engaging and helping with the team's solutions and answers that they're providing to students.
So tell us a little bit about how this took off here in the Bay Area.
I think it's a really interesting story. This, I think, in fall 2011, in some ways, if you want to look at the inspiration behind all of it, Khan Academy that's been around and also here in the Bay Area, Sebastian Thrun, our CEO and founder, was attending a TED Talk. And he was presenting about driverless cars. And at the same TED Talk, he took a break and went to hear Sal Khan present. And when he heard about Sal and his work, he thought, oh my goodness, here's this hedge fund manager who's put videos online and reached thousands of students. And here I am, a Stanford professor, and I've reached, a fair many number of students, but I certainly have not had that huge impact that Sal Khan has had. And this was so inspirational. And that sort of got the seed going where Sebastian wanted to try something and see how it worked. And so in the fall of 2011, he put his artificial intelligence course online together with Peter Norvig, who he, was teaching that class with at Stanford. And just from one email that he sent out, through word of mouth, next thing you knew, there were 160,000 students who had signed up for this class. And, I think that presented its own sort of headache for them and going, oh, my goodness. And I think Sebastian talks about this, like he was envisioning teaching to a stadium of people. How was he ever going to manage that? Which led us really to the seed of what's now become Udacity, which is really that interactive part. And that first pilot where he built his new AI class online really through a series of exercises was sort of the start of Udacity and also sort of instigated a lot of, the Coursera, edX's, all of those things came pretty quickly right after that, partly because I think the results of that pilot, yes, the number 160,000 students is kind of amazing, but what was really interesting was he was teaching at the same time for his 200 students at Stanford, and only about 30 of them continued coming to class. Mm-hmm. And he asked the students, why? And they said, Professor, we love you. It's a really interesting class, but we're getting more out of this series of interactive exercises because we can also stop, rewind, and play you again. There's a norm in the classroom where, smart kids, you don't want to raise your hand more than two or three times in a class and ask the same question if you don't get it. Mm-hmm. Well, they can do that online, and they can work on problems almost like side by side with the professor. And the grades in his class went up a hopeful letter grade by the midterms and by the finals. The distribution of the grades actually tightened, so less people were falling behind. And you know, it was those kinds of signals and outcomes that were so exciting that resulted in some of these, experiments and these platforms starting last year.
I want to reintroduce the program in case you're just joining us. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about MOOCs, massive open online courses, or massive online open courses that have taken hold here in the Bay Area and are sweeping the country and trying to revolutionize the way students learn. And we just heard there from Clarissa Shen, and she is with Udacity, a Palo Alto company that is a platform for putting these online courses together with university instructors. And just in a moment, we'll hear from our other guests, and that's Ellen Jun. She is the provost of San Jose State University, and Dean Flores, who is the CEO of the 20 Million Mile Minds Foundation. I keep wanting to say miles. Welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation at this time. You can call 415-841-4134. If you're a student and have experienced what it's like to take a MOOC course, give us a call and let us know what you think about it. If you're an educator, what kinds of questions come to mind? If you're a parent or anyone else who's interested in perhaps learning this way, what would you like to hear about as we talk about this innovation? 415-841-4134. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. or post a comment at KALW.org. So, Ellen Jun, I wanted to go to you next. You, as a provost, your job is to really make sure that the academic integrity of your institution is preserved, and you steer that ship. Tell us how you think about MOOCs in terms of your role at San Jose State, and why San Jose State chose to be one of the first universities to do MOOCs for credit, which is kind of a new chapter in this innovation.
Yes, thank you. I'm very excited to explain sort of our story. Obviously, San Jose State is the largest public institution that is located here in Silicon Valley, and as sort of the capital of innovation, it seemed only logical that our campus would be interested in investigating a little bit more about the actual implementation of a MOOC on a college campus, because as you know, the MOOC is out there, but it has been launched by companies that are not universities per se. Of course, you know, many of them had connections and origins with universities like MIT and Stanford. So what I did was simply to, as a relative new provost and about a little over a year being at the campus, what I wanted to find out is if any of our faculty would be interested in trying to formally test whether a MOOC environment does help promote student learning. And so I should say two important assumptions. One is that by definition, what we have implemented is no longer considered to be a MOOC in the sense that the MOOC definition says it must be massive, it must be completely online, it must be open or free. And just by having a course that is now counted towards college credit means that students are, being charged for the course, although very, very low charge. From that standpoint, it's not technically a MOOC. Secondly, very important assumption is that all MOOCs are not created equal. So the three biggest providers out there are Coursera, edX, and Udacity. And I have to report to you that San Jose State has partnered with Udacity and with edX. And we haven't yet talked about Coursera. But what I want to say is that the MOOCs are very different from one another. If you go to experience the MOOCs, as Clarissa said, the Udacity pedagogy is vastly different from some that you might find, for example, at others, because it is so much centered on, as she said, interactivity. So I think the one, question that you had for Clarissa is, do students somehow feel lost if they're assuming that, they're many, many students in the class, do they seem lost and distanced from the professor? And what's the interesting thing is, with the pilot courses that we created with Udacity this past fall, and they're running right now, three courses. Students have actually, I had at least one quote, I was searching for it, I couldn't find it right now, but a student actually wrote to their math professor and said, I have never had a course where I feel like the professor is tutoring me individually. And that's because the pedagogical style that is used by Udacity is really like a one-on-one. You see the course mentor drawing out a triangle and saying, well, this is this angle, what do you think? And as Clarissa said, you hear a little bit of a, you know, some content information, and then within 2 to 3 minutes, you're asked, okay, now let's test you. Let's think about this. What would you say about this, that? And they take a little quiz. And so it is, it's never a full lecture. There's no lecture followed by a separate quiz and so forth. It's all interactive, and it feels very much like an individual, you know, faculty member is talking to you, walking you through the material. And it's very context, problem-solving based. And you know, as a developmental cognitive psychologist, those features, plus the fact that there's so much testing, periodic testing as the student progresses, all correlate with deeper learning performance. So we already know that to be in the literature. So it's a very different style of teaching. So what we did with Udacity was to pick three courses with the assistance of Bill Gates. Bill and Melinda met with them, and they were interested, intrigued in the format that Udacity utilizes. And Bill was very interested in to see, does this kind of methodology work with particularly underserved students? If we're trying to help more students acquire a post-secondary degree, you know, could this be done in an online format? So that's why we set up our courses as for gateway courses, difficult courses that were remedial math, college algebra, and introductory statistics. And instead of making it massively open to 160,000 students, we said, let's formally examine whether this would improve student learning. And so we limited it to no more than 100 students in each of three classes. 50 of them are our San Jose, and 50 of them are students who come from underserved, you know, backgrounds. So students that have, you know, communities that are not as, don't have as many monetary resources and so forth. And so that the students are now in those classes, and we're you know, constantly monitoring the. The other thing I have to mention is Udacity has a strong commitment to improving the human interaction. So as you heard Clarissa describe, they hire course mentors whose goal is to check in on the students and, you know, remind them, gee, you haven't been online. Your homework for, you know, section module 2 has not been done. So where are you? Come online and get to work kind of thing. So they're sort of there to support and mentor and monitor students to stay with the pace of an online course. And so we're going to be closely monitoring the results of the students' performance in these three courses. I can give you another quick snapshot for our partnership with edX. In the case of edX, we were not creating. Our faculty did not create the course. The course was already created by MIT. Anant Agrawal's, his very first online MOOC was Electronics and Circuits, an engineering course. And he flew three of our faculty and a grad student to meet with his faculty last summer over July, and my faculty then came back and decided that they wanted to implement a flipped or blended model. So the students were required to, this is a required course for upper division. If you want to be an engineering major, you have to pass this class. Very tough class, both at MIT and here. And our faculty then basically asked the students to take the edX course online material outside of class. Then when they came into class, they were paired into groups of three and worked in teams in structured problem solving as well as quizzing, both at a group level, individual level, you know, for their time on campus. They completely shifted, no longer taught lecture, which was the traditional format, and the professor then worked with the students in these problem-solving groups. And that class took place this past fall. And in December, the students took their final exams, and so we've just almost completed the analysis now, and it was shocking to see the incredible increase in student performance. As I said, really tough course. One section that we piloted in had 86 students, and normally, you know, 59% of them will pass, or so 41% will fail. and have to retake the course, or some of them drop out and do not become engineers. And with the edX blended model, the failure rate went from 41% down to 9%. So 91% of our students passed if they were in the edX version of the class. So, you know, just a remarkably strong achievement. And student motivation and attendance went up to almost 100%, which is, as you know, for many students, it's not always, coming to class is not always fun or easy. But now that it was in this other format, they were coming in much more enthusiastic numbers.
Wow.
So we saw some remarkable achievements, and we're seeing some very strong achievements. Just initially, it's only 5 weeks that we've been doing the Udacity pilot. And I know one example is the intro statistics class. The first exam, 100% of the students took the exam on time, online, and their scores were the same and maybe a little bit higher than the face-to-face class.
Mm.
So we're finding that the students are succeeding with these kinds of different formats.
Well, there's lots of questions that I have for you based on that summary, but I want to make sure we get Dean Flores into our conversation before we get to a couple of calls. So, Dean, thanks for waiting so patiently on the line. You're the CEO of the 20 Million Minds Foundation, a nonprofit that began in 2011, which is really looking at this concern around access to higher education in California, especially around issues of access as they relate to affordability. Tell us how you see this innovation as adding to some of the tools in your toolkit to address the concerns you're battling.
Right. Well, thank you for having me on the show. I think it's fascinating to listen to the discussion prior, because here you have a university that's taken on this great task, San Jose, to actually try to implement a MOOC in a structure that is not used to this, which I think is the real question, and that is, you know, with so many students in our community colleges, our CSU system, and UC either being turned away or being asked to stay at the university longer because they can't find the courses they need, online education is absolutely a no-brainer for the state of California. So I think this MOOC discussion and these emerging MOOCs come at a time because I think it's showing that our current university system is broken, and broken in a way that it does not reflect, I think, even as listening to your conversation earlier, about how we think about college students, and not just community college students, but college students in California. You know, most college students, 90% of them, you know, I would say in community colleges, don't have a residential experience. They're not walking on campus with beautiful trees and going to their dorm. They're traveling to the university. They're older students. They're 23 years and up. Many of them are trying to find courses of convenience that works around their work schedule. And I think if you look at this massive online courses, the reason that they're taking a hold so quickly is not only because they're offering this interactivity that Clarissa just mentioned, and not only because in some senses they are much better than the in-class experience many undergraduates are experiencing at, say, a large class at UCLA where you have 400 students in Psych 1. And you can ask the question during a class time, if even a quarter of them raised their hand for a question, you probably wouldn't finish, you know, a lecture because there are just too many students to actually get a question answered. So here you have all these problems within our university system, and along comes these massive online courses to answer a lot of the questions people had, one about access, one about affordability, one about convenience. And this is why this movement is taking a new breath in terms of moving the universities to a different stage. So I think it's a fascinating type of discussion and implementation. And I congratulate San Jose for stepping out of the mold and asking the question, can we do something different? You know, and I think it's going to lead to a lot of policy changes, I think, as you start to look at how our universities move forward.
This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and we're talking about how the web could change higher education in California through the vehicle of the massive online open course, or MOOC, with our guests Clarissa Shen from Udacity, a Palo Alto company that is creating interactive platforms to create the experiences that we're talking about tonight with the provost of San Jose State University. That's Ellen John. And thus there, we were listening to Dean Flores, who's the CEO of the 20 Million Minds Foundation. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Again, 415-841-4134. You could also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment at klw.org. Let's go to our first caller, Stephen from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me. My name's Stephen. I teach English at the City College of San Francisco and a very large institution, as I'm sure you know. And so I think this is very intriguing, this entire MOOC thing, for all the people who can't get into real classes. And my question is simply, do you guys feel that certain subjects are better sort of tailored towards the MOOC? I mean, certainly you can't teach how to paint or something that's hands-on on an online format. Do you think that writing and English would be a good course to teach online or not?
This is Ellen from San Jose. I think definitely right now the technology is probably more suited to some disciplines better and more amenable than others. Computers still have a way to go in terms of being able to assess and evaluate human writing. That's something that still, places are experimenting. I know that MIT, ETS, a number of other places are looking into that sort of exploring that area. Obviously, the kinds of MOOCs that we have been investing in are more science and math related, so STEM related disciplines, because they are much easier to machine score, quizzes and exams and so forth. But I can tell you that there are other companies that are really moving into the fray in terms of providing interactivity for things that you ordinarily would not think is possible to teach online. For example, languages are being taught online in Australia quite effectively, foreign languages. In addition, speech, students giving speeches and being able to film, videotape themselves and being able to, have those scored online with rubrics also seems to be taking off. So there, as the technology continues to improve and people are ingenious in the way they apply the technologies, it may be possible in the future, to teach, as you say, painting. There, I could imagine that in the same way that someone does a speech, you could watch someone paint. That kind of thing may be possible in the future. But right now, I think that's my feeling, is that some of the STEM-related is easier.
I wonder, Ellen, if the hybrid model that you're experimenting with might be the way to branch out in terms of the kinds of courses you can teach in this method.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of why we are trying some different kinds of formats and, formally testing and evaluating the results. I didn't mention that NSF, National Science Foundation, provided us with the very first funding to a university to study and evaluate the learning efficacy of a MOOC. And so that money was secured to do the analysis for the Udacity model in this case. And so, yes.
415-841-4134 to join our conversation, or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or post a comment at klw.org. Let's go to our next caller, Ben, also from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Great. This is fantastic. I've taken a number of courses through Udacity, EDX, and Coursera, so I'm loving it. And it's great to hear that some courses are now accredited, and it might be moving more in that direction. My question is, in just looking ahead a little bit, has there been talk about offering entire majors through these MOOC platforms as opposed to just standalone subjects, or rather subjects that you can take one up? I see that some subjects like statistics are progressive, their stats 1, 2, and 3 say, but entire majors, has there been talk of that?
Who wants to take that? How about Ellen John again?
Well, I think that's the nation and the world is sort of holding their breath and thinking about, well, what implication might this have for actual degrees and or certificates? And I think that would be a logical next step. Obviously, to get to that point requires a great deal more logistics, because degrees are offered by institutions of higher learning, which have accreditation, and accreditation, of course, as well as campus internal approval processes for degree programs can be quite complex. So it is something that I think that is going to be on the forefront very shortly, and it is something that I think that people are waiting to see. Would they have access to a college degree in this online format? And I think it would be obviously a very worthwhile project to move into that arena.
All right, 415-841-4134. I just want to ask a couple of questions before we go to another few callers here. So the question came up about authenticating learners. I had to say, Ellen, when I was hearing about the jump up in your pass rates,
yeah.
I was wondering, I've heard some concerns around cheating, and how do we know that the students that are really saying they're taking the course are taking it, so you're giving them that credit? How are you dealing with that? And maybe both Clarissa and Ellen, you can speak to that question.
Sure. Well, in the case of the increase, to 91 pass rate, that is nothing. Those students still came to class, so they actually took all their exams in class. It was a standard exam for their section as well as for the other non-edX sections, so it was a common exam. And so the students were proctored just as they would in a normal class. So there was, if there's cheating, it would be comparable to what might sometimes occur in a face-to-face bricks-and-mortar class. So that there wasn't authentication issues there.
I see.
In the case of the Udacity, Udacity and our campus has at least, three different forms of identity authentication, maybe really four, which is far more than perhaps, many others. So, for example, we use ProctorU, which is a company that does require face state ID authentication, visual identification. It also then requires that the student take the camera. The camera then surveys the room that they're in. And thirdly, the ProctorU freezes their desktop, so they cannot surf for questions or do email or anything. So they, they can only work on the exam. They can't use their computer for anything but the exam.
I see.
The fourth thing that we do is we do ask them to sign an honor pledge of academic integrity each time they take the quiz. So just to make them remind them how important it is that this must be their own work. And only their own work as they take the quizzes.
Hmm. So Clarissa, I'm going to jump to the next question, which is there's been a lot of talk of, and now maybe not in the San Jose model because they're actually submassive, I would call them, courses, but in the traditional MOOC model, there's a huge amount of people who sign up at first, and then there's a massive dropout rate. Mm-hmm. How do you explain that, and is that cause for concern, or is that sort of part of this landscape, and is that okay with you, that there's a lot of people who sign up at first and then it drops off quite a bit?
I mean, obviously, of course, we'd love to see, much higher completion rates and love to see more people getting through a whole course. But we're also okay with it in that it's a really massive scale and you're getting a very heterogeneous audience in there. So you can imagine there are people in there who are learning it because they want to refresh their knowledge. Well, they should not need to complete a whole course because it may be that they only need, 3, 4, 7 out of, 8 or 9 units. And they're never going to complete it because the rest of the stuff they know. So people who are using for refreshing their knowledge, people who are retirees who are, wanting to learn for the love of learning and engaging that way. We have, young students, middle school students who are taking this because they're bored in class and they want extra stimulation and learning. And so, you'd really, because of that huge heterogeneity in terms of the audience that comes in, you really almost have to segment that further down to see, well, what were their learning goals? Because they're coming with very different learning goals. And for all those learning goals to be served, I don't think you're going to be looking at the same metrics and same completion rates for each of those segments because they're completely motivated in different ways.
415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment at klw.org. Let's go next to Fred from Berkeley. Fred, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm a community college instructor, have been for 25 years, and call me old-fashioned, but I find that some of the most important learning goes on in my classroom through conversations, through the students talking with one another, through the synergy that occurs when you have people in a room with one another. And it just seems to me that this is part of a trend that we face in, you just look around in public spaces as everybody's staring into their smartphones and not talking to each other. And that this is sort of an alienated model of education. And how do you explain how this would not contribute more to that kind of forward motion in our society toward more atomized people not talking with one another, not relating well with one another?
I think those are great questions, and we get them often. But what's been really surprising, I think, as part of the experience and observing the communities that have sprung up, is just how social this actually is. And I think, you know, no one's downplaying the fact that education is very social. And I think, you know, there's also things that this online format will not replace, at least in the short term, because people still want to go to campuses, still want to have that community feeling. But we have meetups that are springing up all over the place that students are organizing, and they're getting together in coffee shops, sometimes socially at bars, to talk about the questions that they've been struggling with online in the last couple days, weeks. So we're seeing, you know, in many ways, a lot of this happening offline, and that person-to-person, and I think you're specifically talking about, you know, in-person kind of interactions, because certainly there's a lot of virtual interactions that happen in our forums, in Facebook, where people are setting up their own communities because of their shared interest in courses. But in these in-person meetings, people are still setting them up, you know, in their communities. And they're meeting new people that they otherwise may not have met because they have a shared interest in some of these learning objectives in these courses. And we think that's incredibly exciting, and have definitely seen friendships and even organizations and companies come out of people who have taken our courses online and met each other offline.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go next to Steve from Palo Alto. Welcome to the program. Steve, are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
Okay, great, Steve. Go ahead.
I was just wondering what kind of legal issues these pioneers, dealt with. I mean, I'm thinking of things like intellectual property issues. I'm also thinking of things like the education code and, you know, whether or not there's a certain amount of class time that's required. So, generically, I'm just wondering because these are pioneers, I was just wondering what folks dealt with. And I'll take my answer by hanging up.
Okay, thanks so much,
okay,
Steve.
I can address the IP issue, intellectual property. This is Ellen from San Jose. That was an extremely important principle that I wanted to make sure that we had agreement with. And so Udacity has been outstanding in terms of recognizing and affirming the intellectual property rights of faculty who are creating new courses and new materials. So in our agreements between our faculty and Udacity, our faculty still retain all of their intellectual property rights for material that they have constructed solely on their own. And then for material that is constructed in tandem, in conjunction with each other, they share the intellectual property rights with Udacity, so that each party may play a role in, if there are other, you know, uses for that material, then they come to an agreement together. So that was a very important feature for most faculty, to feel that they retain their intellectual property rights for that, for their material that they construct, which is now, you know, videoed and shown online. So that's a very important feature that we did, you know, deal with. As to the credit hour issue, that one is not a problem, because, in fact, the students are probably logging in more time, and we can actually, for the first time, quantify that and verify it, because we can tell when they log on at what time, which sections are they reading, which exams are they take or quizzes are they taking, what are their scores, and so forth. So we actually have verifiable amount of time, and so the amount of time they're actually spending online probably certainly exceeds what they'd spend coming to class and spending 75 minutes twice a week sitting in class listening to a lecture.
I'd add to that, Ellen. I think part of it is, what we are really excited about is also the data that we bring to bear, right? In all of these courses, there's providing a lot more transparency in terms of quality and what's happening and how students are learning and what they're actually learning in the classrooms. I think on the question of, you know, legal issues, I'm not sure if this falls into that, but I think part of what Dean was applauding San Jose State for doing is being a pioneer means really investigating something and not having all the questions, and not having all the answers to all the questions. Accreditation, I think, is a big part of the question, and one of the earlier listeners was asking about a degree. Well, it's maybe on the cusp, but there's a reason why there isn't a degree yet, because the way accreditation works, there's a lot of things that accreditation requires that currently are just not part of what all massive online open course would do. For example, certain faculty to student ratio is kind of a different animal with a MOOC. And seat time, you know, I think in many ways seat time, that old metric is probably already being eroded in many different places, given that so much of it should be probably much more about activity time and student doing time. And we absolutely value learning by doing and showing actual application of learning. And so how do you measure that versus a unit that's called seat time? So there are a lot of questions that we don't have answers to.
Okay, so I want to go to our next caller. We have actually a professor's perspective. This might be someone you recognize, Ellen. We have Ron Rogers, a professor at San Jose State as well, who wants to give his perspective on the professor's experience, maybe to speak to some of the other instructors who have called in concerned about what it means to kind of move to this kind of a platform for teaching. So, Ron, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us about your experience in teaching this kind of course, and also speak for us to the issue of how this kind of learning works with some of the concerns about the learning gap for disadvantaged students.
Well, my experience so far, first I wanted to say that this is very much a team effort. A colleague of mine, Dr. Sean Lairway, is also involved developing the course, as is Katie Kormanik, who is a Udacity employee. So we're all three of us are, as a team, kind of developing this and really standing on the shoulders of many great people at Udacity. And it really has been a wonderful experience. We were drawn to Udacity in this project because of the approach. Both Sean and I teach our courses very traditionally. We lecture for 50 minutes or so and then break them into small groups and have them use statistics. So we're working on the statistics course. And we were attracted to the Udacity model, and that was to not have the instructor speak for more than 2 minutes before asking the student, do you understand, or can you think about the concepts that we're talking about? Can you show us your understanding? And so it's a very different approach than what we've used traditionally, and we thought that it might be very effective in reaching students who traditionally struggle with this elementary statistics course.
And how so?
How so? Well, for one, students approach this course with a tremendous fear of mathematics and a tremendous fear of statistics. And I think the Udacity approach eases them into this process in the sense that you have these small victories. I think Clarissa talked about this earlier in terms of empowering the student. So very early on, within the first 34 seconds of the class, the student is asked to respond to something. And we try to set it within a context. Our first module, the whole goal of the module is to answer the question of, well, you have an exam tomorrow. What time do you think you should go to bed tonight? And so we're trying to couch statistics in real-life experiences and then have the students quickly succeed in answering, in realizing that they intuit statistics all the time. And I think that does empower the students. We have to see yet. This is an ongoing experiment. But the idea is to give them success early on, and that allows them the confidence to succeed throughout the course.
Well, thank you so much for your call. Ellen, I'm realizing that this is probably springing into another topic for another show of the psychology of learning and how the psychology of learning is really intimately connected to our digital age and how children and others right now are looking for constant sort of gratification and validation that they're doing the right thing, and we're kind of really feeding into that with this pedagogical model. We actually don't have time to go there, but I'm just wondering if we can invite you back for another time for that topic. I want to try to squeeze in one more caller. We have Justin, who's a professor from Cal State as well. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much. So I have heard that MOOCs are the answer to students not getting enough access to education. Like I said, I'm an adjunct, and I can't get enough work. I keep asking for more classes so I can make a living, and I keep getting turned down. Meanwhile, I have students on my wait list every semester trying to get into my classes. I don't think the answer is MOOCs. The answer is to give people like me more work and to hire more teachers. Anyways, thanks.
Okay. So, Ellen, do you want to speak to that? Because we haven't really talked about the cost of putting this on and what it means for the quote-unquote business model of academia, but perhaps also the business model of companies like Udacity.
Well, and it's, all of that is still kind of an unanswered, unexplored territory. It's never happened before. I mean, the courses that we're offering through our extension program are costing students $150, which is a very low cost. It's just slightly higher than what we didn't want to outprice our community college colleagues, who charge $46 a unit, and these are all three-unit courses by and large. So, but in answer to the question, what this actually might do is produce more teaching opportunities for faculty, because if we're able to offer more courses through this model, more access, then that makes it more possible for students to enter and be qualified to enter into a four-year college institution. So they're actually, it's the idea that, a rising tide lifts all boats, and it actually may help us to move forward in many positive directions.
But I wonder, if there's more people signing up for any particular course, why would you need more instructors over time?
Well, because I don't, this is what's unexplored. We don't know. The 160,000 people that sign up for any given MOOC, very small percentage of them actually complete. And so that's the question, is it really feasible to put 160,000 who are going to complete with one instructor? We're not sure if that's possible. I mean, that's the implication that one can draw. But it's still an unanswered question, but it's one that's very intriguing and that we need to take some more time to study.
Okay. And I know, I'm sorry, Dean Flores, we didn't get a chance to get back to you. Any last thoughts about how this phenomenon could really help really get at the concerns that your organization is worried about?
No, I think it's just an issue. I was listening to this fascinating conversation about, it isn't about, how, it's about when. And I think this is really a reality, and I think it's a question of how to put it all together. So it actually helps students. MOOCs are, in some cases, interest-based. We need to make them academic-based, giving students a pathway through the college when they have impacted courses or sit on waiting lists. So that's the real test. So it'll be interesting to see how this moves through in the next couple of years.
And Clarissa, what is on the horizon, briefly?
We're doing a couple more courses with San Jose State. And one of the things we're really interested in this summer is also, as we start offering these for credit and in the summer, it's a different time when many students are not traditionally engaged in learning. And that's really, an old model back when we had agrarian calendars. Now, it'd be really interesting to see in the summer, as we continue to do this, whether there's a whole new group of students who get access to higher education, who get ahead, high school students who are entering college, how they can potentially get ahead, and we're already working with some high school partners on that front, and I think that'll be very interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Obviously, a lot of interest, and sorry we couldn't get to all of our callers tonight. I want to thank Dean Flores, CEO of the 20 Million Minds Foundation, Ellen John, Provost of San Jose State University, and Clarissa Shen of Udacity. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure.
For our list of other shows and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, podcasts, search for the City Vision's webpage at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Bob Summer, thanks to our producer, Victoria Thorpe. Our senior producer is Susie Britton. Join my co-host, Lauren Meltzer, next week when we talk about the new philanthropy. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.